L. Frank Baum's timeless story, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, gets a funky reimagining in this lavish adaptation of a landmark Broadway show based on the book. Diana Ross brings her show-stopping star power to the role of Dorothy. Here, a Harlem schoolteacher who is magically transported to a surreal fantasy land that resembles New York City, complete with man-eating trash cans and a disco paradise. Propelled by the musical contributions of Quincy Jones and an all-star cast that includes Michael Jackson, Richard Pryor, Lena Horne, this dazzling soul spectacular from legendary director Sidney Lumet reframes a beloved tale through the Black experience, creating a powerful celebration of self-determination. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Criterion Sessions on One Heat Minute Productions. My name is Blake Howard. This is a show where we go through and review physical media from the lovely folks at the Criterion Collection, one of the world's premier labels. And today I have a premier guest to talk about a blockbuster that's been reclaimed over the last few years. It didn't make a splash on its preliminary release. It took some time to be sort of reclaimed by the culture, despite the fact that it stars names like Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Nipsey Russell, Ted Ross, Teresa Merritt, Lena Horne, and Richard Pryor. I'm today talking to the awesome Candace Frederick, who's an award-winning culture reporter and critic, and we are talking about the cinematic adaptation from 1978 of The Wiz. Hey, Candace.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, man.
I'm so sorry. Every time I talk to my American friends, I'm like, how you doing? And I just hear this, oh, man. Just like this, I'm fine. Yeah. It's fun to talk about culture, but also, God.
It's you're constantly surrounded by just like exasperation. It's like, where do I begin?
Can today just be even just moderately better than yesterday?
That's all we can hope for.
So The Wiz has come out on this beautiful 4K edition from Criterion, got a stack of different features, audio commentaries from different scholars, great essays by Aisha Harris in here. You and I were just talking about it before we sort of kicked off recording for the show, but like, I think that this might be one of the longest time between drinks, so to speak, of me watching a movie. I'm like, I watched this as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was maybe 5 or 6. I was young, like, you know, in that. And I watched it, and I haven't watched it in ages since. And part of that reason is probably just because in Australia, it hasn't existed on physical media or hasn't played on a station. It just never had the same, you know, dominant circulation of the, you know, the original film adaptation. So I was really pleased to watch it, and I feel like I'm vastly more educated about the sort of American new Hollywood circa 1968 to sort of 80, like that era. And so it was really fun to sort of be brought back into this time and see this movie adaptation. And I also thought maybe just the quality of movies has dipped, because like at the time, the critical response was mixed to negative, right? And you did have a big dominant white perspective in media who weren't a big fan, and has the really uncomfortable and harrowing comparison to the original Wizard of Oz, which is just unfair. But look at all those, look at this beautiful New York, weird New York with bins that come alive, and look at these people who emerge out of the walls, and look at these stars, these huge stars that are coming in, and this like kind of eclectic impressions of all this different Black culture that like permeated through, despite the fact it's written by the gayest man of all time, Joel Schumacher, who is heroically gay and behind so many great films, and directed by Sidney Lumet, who is one of the most prolific filmmakers of all time, got his chops in making live television before moving into cinema. So where does The Wiz sit for you?
You know, I am of a very tiny minority of Black folks who do not have a, how do I say it? I guess like a special relationship with this movie. I'm interested because I know the first time you saw the movie was when you were a child, and then you saw it again recently. I wonder because I actually have only just seen this movie like within the last 2 years,
Yes.
obviously as an adult. So I wonder if I would have a different reaction because I didn't see this as a child. But I'll tell you, in the Black community, this was like certified platinum, Oscar winning, like Pulitzer Prize winning, like in most households. And so, except mine, it just kind of flew over my roof and just never really landed. And so when I saw it recently, I was just like, oh, like it's almost like, oh, is this what people really think?
Is this the thing that everyone said was the best?
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm sitting with it. But I mean, like, I think there's like this theoretical response I could have, like, or not so much theoretical, this more like I get it, but I don't personally get it type of thing. Where
Yes.
it's like, you know, if I were to watch this late 70s, early 80s event, and also understanding what was going on in cinema at the time, what was going on culturally at the time, I would probably have a different relationship with that, with this movie too. I mean, like, one, there wasn't a whole lot of movies like rooted in, I wouldn't even say this is particularly rooted in the Black experience. I mean, this is a remake of a white movie.
Yeah.
So I want to be
Per
really clear on
perhaps
that.
perhaps the whitest movie of all time.
Right. And a very good movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is like bare bones, like a remake of a white movie, so it's not really rooted in the Black experience. It has been recentered among Black people. But I think the idea of seeing Black people, Black characters in weird circumstances is to this day an anomaly. And when I
Yeah.
say weird, something that's like not like the straightforward drama. Like we're seeing like fantastical elements visually and narratively just happening, just like no one's really questioning it. It's just like, okay, this is just the reality that we have here. And like that's just not something that was very prominent in Hollywood at the time. And certainly not even now.
No.
So I think there's a lot. You know, if I'm watching this as a child in 1978, honestly, even watching this as an adult in 1978, I feel like I would have like my mind would be absolutely blown. And there are some really wondrous like visual images throughout the movie that's just like, in addition to like letting Black characters be weird and in weird circumstances, which is already a feat in itself. It's just a pretty film to look at that's also just increasingly weird. It's like, I don't know, it's weird because like when you think about the original Wizard of Oz and you kind of raise the question, what if this story, but with Black people? And then of course everybody would be like, oh God, we would
Oh
never be in
no.
this like
You're
that.
like
It would
you wouldn't be in this story. It would be kind of
right.
it would be kind of awful because you're kind of
Right.
positioned in this weird like Jim Crow era, like segregation in black and white oppression, and then you go into this colorful new world where you've got all this power, and then what's the end? Like there's no place like home doesn't exactly resonate if you're not
Right.
going back. So it's kind of, yeah, I felt that too. I was trying to do that weird mental movie math in my head going, okay, so the way that they're centering Dorothy and her kind of beautiful family at the beginning is they're centering it around this sort of like what would become like known in our cultural parlance is like that Cosby concept, this like black family who's like successful and happy and growing and thriving. And there's hope with the turn of the decade that civil rights movement is like everything's moving forward. And so Dorothy wants to go home and wants to jump out on her own and get out of this stasis that she's been in. So, you know, there's an excitement there that, you know, when she goes home, she's going to her life's going to change for the better. It's going to grow. It's new experiences are coming. She can step out of her home and not be so sheltered. But yeah, that would be the one for one because of literally oppression would not be cool. It's not a, there's no escape. It'd be like, I want to stay in Oz. I'm taking over rather than I'm going home. It's like, I'm going to kick this chump Richard Pryor out of this whiz role and I'm in charge now.
That's true. I mean, it's I like that it allows Black characters to be in really not just weird and strange circumstances, but really just like escape, like go deeper into the imagination, just like the universal imagination.
Yes.
And that's something that we still don't really see a lot of. So I appreciate that. And as it goes kind of further into the depths of imagination, you it continues to just like be like, because the question I keep going back to the question is like, would a Black person find themselves in this situation? But like the film, you know, like it doesn't care. And I kind of appreciate that about it. And I think that's what I think that's part of what I think a lot of Black people really appreciate about it too, where it's just like, oh, this isn't a character who's tethered to this sense of this overwhelming sense of strife that's so prominent in American cinema.
Yes.
When it comes to Black faces, it's like let's send them on a journey that's just like not that's just a little bit ridiculous, but also really entertaining at the same time. Or not even just a little bit ridiculous, totally ridiculous, but like really entertaining. And then like let's put like the biggest stars in this
Yeah.
movie too.
I mean, pound for pound, the stars are incredible. And yeah, I. When I watched it as a kid, just to talk to you about like my experience of that specific viewing, it was like, oh, here's so incorrectly, might I add, which didn't happen so much when I was given movies. They're like, this is the sequel to The Wizard of Oz. And I was like, great, let's watch it. And so after being confused for probably an hour and a half of a 2 hour movie of like, this is just The Wizard of Oz, I kind of was just, it didn't resonate. I saw Michael Jackson and I'm like, oh my God. You know, I saw Richard Pryor and I'm like, oh my God, because at, you know, that stage of my life, these are people that I knew. I didn't know, I didn't recognize Diana Ross from the Diana Ross that I'd seen in film clips at the time of seeing it. And obviously this movie was much earlier, but I was like, there wasn't anyone that was like extremely recognizable to me across the board, but I was like, oh, okay. All right. Yeah, great. By the end of it, I was like, yeah, this is fun. Like, it's just The Wizard of Oz again, a remake. I do like what you said about the untethering. Like, it's really hard to kind of untether the like Black experience from the Black culture that's on show. So it's kind of nice that the movie tries and I think succeeds to find a way. But it's really interesting. You brought up a bigger point, which happens with all these like what you get told or is heralded as classics for so many people. When you actually finally visit it, you have this weird, and especially for someone like you or I, who are people who are like observe culture and think about it critically, you have this weird thing like, oh, isn't tech this technical thing very nice? You know, isn't this tech, you know, isn't this very cool that they did this? Or isn't this cast really great? Or isn't this like celebration of different Black cultures, you know, both physically in dance or in the music or in the song choices or in the choreography or in the different aesthetics? Isn't this all like really nice? Isn't that like, haven't they taken this to kind of like a beautiful Gene Kelly-esque like classic Hollywood musical, turning New York City into a stage, you know, on a back lot and taking different elements of New York City and fantasizing them for us on the screen. And then you just have to ask yourself, like, did it resonate? And like, so many times you can look at something objectively and be like, yeah, like I like the technical, I can agree that it's good. I love the stars. I love all the things that I'm seeing. Did it resonate with me? Would I ever watch it again? It might be a no. But I think that I actually played this. I've now watched it like twice. One time before us like working out a time to chat about it, and now this time immediately before watching it, before chatting now, and I had my daughter watch it with me, and she doesn't she's never seen The Wizard of Oz. She's only seen Wicked, which she loves. And I was like, oh, this is like The Wizard of Oz, because she knows about The Wizard of Oz, knows conceptually what it is, has seen enough of the detail in Wicked. I'm like, oh, this is called The Wiz. It's a version of that. And she was really into it. Like she was a little bit like cautious because it was a bit scary. Like when people peeled themselves off the walls, she nearly peeled herself off the couch and ran away. But it was really cool to watch it through her eyes because she's seeing it without that cultural context. And that's not to say that I wanted to watch stuff like that, but it's just like she's 8. And so we're not having any of those conversations right now. But she's totally down with like, this is just a great concept. I hope there's cool songs like Defying Gravity that I can sing. And that's all that was there for her. There was none of this like racial lens or is this, none of that was there because she's watched Wicked and she's like, oh yeah, this is what the world of Wizard of Oz looks like. I wonder if we go back to the original Wizard of Oz, she's like, where's all the people that I like that are black and brown? Where are they?
Totally.
So yeah, really, really fascinating. But I was also just, looking at this for me from like one of my favorite filmmakers is Sidney Lumet. I think he's an amazing director. And so it's really interesting just looking at him and his career at the time. Joel Schumacher becomes like a big Hollywood entity, goes on to make movies himself, write movies. But like just in the sequence of, after making a bazillion hours of live TV, his 70s go like Serpico, Loving Molly, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, and then The Wiz. Like, it's a crazy sequence of movies.
It's a weird trajectory, and I think when the few black folks I have talked to about the movie in more critical terms, because again, it's really considered a sacred movie, so it's hard to like have any kind of critical discussions about it. But like there are a few I've talked to that's just like, that is something that they point out quite a bit, or just like the trajectory of Sidney Lumet doing all those movies that you just described, and then like, let me hit you with like The
Let me hit
Wiz,
you
which
with
is
the
like
whiz.
this far right turn.
Yeah, the biggest.
It's interesting, and I don't know what provoked that, but I've always maintained that particularly within this era, and certainly prior to this era of Hollywood films, black movies couldn't be, or often I feel like black directors, it was more difficult for them to make movies altogether, but also to make
Incredibly.
movies that were right, that also to make movies that were outside of the vein that white Hollywood saw black images. And this is so far outside of like, I don't know, like the learning tree. And I'm thinking of like movies that are good, but are very much centered around elements of racial strife. And not to say that films should divorce themselves from that, but this movie entirely allows the audience and the characters, these characters that we are already familiar with, to experience the fantastical and not
Yes.
experience the struggle in that sense. There's struggle in this movie, but not in the sense that I think we've become all too acquainted with for when it comes to Black Hollywood films.
Yeah, we're talking about the core blaxploitation era is overlaid over that 1968 to sort of 1980 time as well, with one of the biggest years being 73, which has Black Caesar, Blackenstein, Cleopatra Jones, Coffee, Detroit 9000, which I love to pieces, is one of the coolest movies of all time. Anytime I get to mention it, amazing. Superfly TNT. And if you go now to 78, like we're talking about like act martial arts, action movies, Death Dimension, and it does cite The Wiz, which is as a blaxploitation movie. And I'm like, well, hold on, it's not. It's like it's not a blaxploitation movie in a sense. It's a huge studio movie with huge sets and it's a musical, but it is absolutely benefiting from the prevalence of like blaxploitation in culture. It's like, oh, we're going to just center black people in this. We're going to incorporate pieces of black culture in amongst the sort of weirdness in the adaptation. We're going to have all of this stuff. And maybe reflexively, we could say, like, well, is The Wiz like centering this in a big thing starting to really permeate the mainstream of like black actors there, like going across, jumping across from blaxploitation into, into the mainstream, maybe.
Yeah, it's definitely we were definitely seeing more, a little bit more variety, and I would say blaxploitation, part of what made blaxploitation so prominent is that a lot of those movies, but a lot of other movies, but a good number of those movies were helmed by black directors. There
Exactly.
were quite a few that were not, many that were not, but there was like this sense of ownership that was happening. So it wasn't just put black images on screen, but put black images on screen helmed by people who actually understand the black image and have lived the black image type of thing. And then there was a whiz, and like somewhere within that this movie happened.
Yeah, well, like Joel Schumacher is American, a New Yorker, but is absolutely as white as it gets. And Sidney Lumet is, also a white New Yorker. And so in some ways it's like the challenge is like taking a tangent for a brief moment is like one of the recent podcasts I did on our series on our feed was American Psycho. And which adapts the Bret Easton Ellis book. And there are a lot of Bret Easton Ellis acolytes out there. He was like a huge cynic, arbiter of cool, written so many things that had so many, he was such a raconteur when he would go on stage. I think that the adaptation of his book, American Psycho, is a masterpiece because Mary Harron, a woman, is the gaze of that movie. And the underlying emptiness and soullessness and greed and sheer disgust that we have as an audience for the way that these people behave is so great because it's a woman that is like eviscerating this character, Patrick Bateman, the entire time that he's like,
Going on these tangents.
going on his doing his thing, shall we say? I don't know any other nice way to say it other than talk very gruesomely. And I think that while the best of intentions and the adaptation is great, and there are these big filmmakers that are trying to push it, it's just like there's a gap. There's a gap between if this was an anointment of like a big emerging black filmmaker that gets to helm this project with these stars versus Sidney Lumet. It just feels like there would be a gap. Of course there would be.
And I don't know, I don't really know how to describe what that gap is in for
Yes,
this movie, just
agree.
because it's like to borrow my friend's phrase, it's blackety black. And when I say that, I mean it's a movie that is obviously done by white people, helmed
Yes.
by white people, but it's like they got the blackest people to like populate the movie, like beyond them, like
Was
and
that
we all
black be black?
know there are levels, man. Like
There
there
are
are
levels.
levels.
That's so good. Who is your friend that came up with that phrase? That's so fun.
Yeah, meaning like this sense of like, okay, like I mean I'm definitely putting words in their mouth, but I'm like a white guy, or and for Joel Schumacher's case, I am a white gay guy. I need to go find the people who are revered by black audiences who are also black. So Diana Ross, Quincy Jones, who we have not talked about
Oh, we
because
haven't
he
spoken.
is like everything.
Yeah, he's Quincy is everything. Yeah. In this
Yes.
period, he's everything.
Right. I mean, the genius of Quincy Jones, who obviously did so much with Michael Jackson, but was also a composer. I mean, did a bunch of things, and so was
If
revered.
he'd only done Thriller, he
Yeah.
could retire. This is what I hate about some like pop culture people. Like you have like filmmakers, for example, Sidney Lumet, who I love. Like I love the concept that for me, when I look at his resume, the guy made Serpico, he made Dog Day Afternoon, he made Network, he made The Verdict. For me, that's it. I don't care if he made 60 movies. If anyone's like, "Oh, I didn't like some of his movies," I'm like, "Did you not like Serpico? Did you not like one of the great?" It's the same. A whole arc happens with Francis Ford Coppola or people who argue about Scorsese. I'm like, "Can you stop?" They gave us some of the most important movies in culture. It's like if you don't like some of their latest movies, it's like when they start going, "Were they really that good?" Yeah, they were. Absolutely. Everyone is. They were, and their work is important. And it's just, let's not have this argument anymore. It's done. It's over.
Seriously,
Some
I
people,
mean, it's not to be questioned, I don't think.
no, I'm the same way. It's like some people are like, "I don't like the latest Spielberg." I'm like, "Yeah, but he gave you Jaws and E.T. and also he gave you a big helping of Shut the Fuck Up, okay?" Because
Most importantly.
it's just like he gave you this huge helping of like once he made those, you just can be quiet now because it's done. Like they're so important to culture. So yeah, no, like I love that you said that. It's like these guys who are entrusted with this adaptation, which, sorry, I'm not sure if we mentioned it yet, but had been a huge, like it had a sort of softish opening on Broadway, but then it became a smash and then it won Best Musical at the Tonys, and this adaptation was like, "Oh, okay, great." So much faster than bloody Wicked. Wicked took a million years to go from the stage to the screen and was a big smash as well, but it leapt onto the screen, and you know, Sidney Lumet, New York guy making this thing that had generated out of Broadway. Joel Schumacher out of New York had been a Broadway guy as well, so they definitely had the right pedigree. But yeah, it's just that question of like, what is that quotient that we'll that unanswerable quotient that we'll never know of like what it would be like, you know, imagining if we could get Ryan Coogler in a time machine and throw him back to make The Wiz, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think there was a recent revival of The Wiz on Broadway, and I say recent. I think it's I must have seen that like last year. It had to be last year, and so and that was kind of one opportunity. One opportunity that revival gave was to kind of put the story into the hands of a few Black writers, choreographers, director, I'm pretty sure. And so, and I think that was the first adaptation of The Wiz in any format that did that. But I think something that I've heard and I've said as well is that if you're gonna be, not really somebody who's rooted in the experience or like looks like your characters, at least bring into the fold other creatives who actually can help validate the vision that you have. And I think going back to Quincy Jones, because I think he is such an important element of the movie, because the songs that we've already, kind of alluded to earlier in our discussion are part of what elevates this movie. I mean, it's all kind of just wild and ridiculous, but like, the song's really rooted in something so much greater than it probably should be. It's just like, wow, this is like, about a belonging and yes, this idea of home, this idea of soaring, this idea of just like being bigger than you have been told. All these things that are just like, oh, this is it's doing a lot, but it's like it's meaningful in ways that you probably don't expect from a movie like this.
Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store at Lowe's.com for details.
Yeah, so Quincy has his breakthrough. I mean, he starts his career in the 50s in jazz, and then in the 60s he actually works on one of the first as it for his first film score. He got an invitation from Sidney Lumet to do the score for The Pawnbroker, which is awesome. Great movie. And he does that. Then he starts doing some he's like his credits are I'm trying to get the best ones. He does The Italian Job, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, The Out-of-Towners, They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, which is a In the Heat of the Night sequel. He's doing all these sorts of things. And then I'll just read you this little stat, Candice, which is so fun. It's like after he produced the soundtrack for The Wiz, he then did Off the Wall 20 million copies, Thriller 65 million copies, and Bad 45 million copies.
It's wild.
And then
It really is.
he's nominated for Oscars. He does The Color Purple, so Steven Spielberg works with him. Like Quincy Jones, my word. Like he's just like, and then he was like the patron saint of once he was established of music, making these always being around the scene and people using him as a guide and as a wizened, guy who would like guide different projects and connect people together. But yeah, I mean, absolutely incredible. And this was his peak, like 78, like he was already hitting big on film scores. He does The Wiz, and then after that he's in pop music, and then he's in everyone's lives forever.
Forever. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when I think about the combination of Quincy Jones, Diana Ross, I'll even throw in like Nipsey Russell and certainly Michael Jackson and certainly Lena Horne too. I think about this sense of like you get extremely recognizable black faces. I mean, maybe Nipsey Russell isn't as recognizable to certain audiences, but largely speaking, you get very extremely recognizable names to black audiences that are also, and this is like kind of rare at the time. Maybe it's a little less rare now, but like you get those names that are extremely recognizable to black audiences that are almost as recognizable to white audiences. And that is a hard thing to pull off. It's something we talk about a lot, like are they white famous or are they black famous? Like are they famous to certain audiences, things like that. But these are people who were like, it has the makings of an actual blockbuster because you have all the things that are going for it.
I've got a friend, Craig Lindsay, who's a Texas-based now critic, and he's African American, and he's like, Blake, let me tell you something. In my house, we were talking about Sidney Poitier. He's like, we weren't watching, we weren't watching things like Lilies in the Field, The Defiant Ones, or Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. We were watching Buck and the Preacher and Uptown Saturday Night and A Piece of the Action when he was directing, blaxploitation movies, using his cultural cachet to do that. And so, yeah, like Sidney Poitier is one of those people who had an immediate cultural crossover, but like for the black community, it was like when Sidney came back and made blaxploitation fun, action oriented films, not like message movies. That's when he really meant something to the culture. And so, yeah, but I think by the time we get to like the 70s, 80s, especially because Hollywood steals from everything, every genre, every country, every cool thing starts to get sort of appropriated in the kind of cool, in the best sort of melting pot kind of way. But they were looking at blaxploitation movies and saying, I'll have some of that. Like, oh, I'm what they were looking at it. So those stars all started to burst out, and the 80s are kind of the peak. That's, the true emergence of like pop music, and then hip hop, and then it's off to the races, and then black culture is such the is a is the pioneer, is leading, and I think other things are trying to chase to catch up.
Yeah, it's so interesting that I never really considered The Wiz in the blaxploitation conversation, and now it's all I can think about because you've brought it up a few times, and I'm just like, huh, I never really put it there. Yeah, I mean, I had to think about also just like the root, the purpose, the impetus of Blaxploitation. And I think there's a lot that people have kind of, I don't want to say distorted, but the definition has certainly evolved, where it's just like, you know, is it kind of one of those things, like I think about Shaft, I think about like largely male, alpha male characters like a Shaft, but then of course you have Coffee and oh my gosh, why can't I think of like any other Pam Grier movie right now, but like a lot of her movies,
Yeah,
but she was like,
Cleopatra Patrick Jones, right?
yes, exactly. I was gonna say Cleopatra. I was like, wait, but it's not actually Cleopatra. It's Cleopatra Jones. It's actually like, you know, kind of still like a reference to a character that has been played by a white actor before, but like you're kind of
Oh, and
twisting it.
Foxy Brown, we both missed that one. How dare
Foxy
we?
Brown, oh my gosh, yes.
How do we miss
Yeah.
Foxy Brown when there's a Jackie Brown that's literally like
Right. Right.
ripping the name, yeah.
Yes. It's interesting though, and I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that Sydney Poitier, Sydney Lumet
Sorry,
and
I jumbled this up. I went to another Sydney. Sorry.
no. Sydney Lumet and Joel Schumacher kind of, you know, brought this. It's interesting because people forget almost that they're attached to the movie. I mean, obviously in this very significant way, because it's something that is so warmly and intensely embraced by Black audiences that it's just like, it's like there is no white person even attached to this movie, but actually like pretty crucial white figures are attached to this.
But
But yeah,
they
it's
sort of smartly in their legacy too, not that they distanced themselves from it because they were clearly proud, but they centered the right people, right? Like they just kind of like went, we're gonna make this and we're gonna do our best, but we're gonna put the most prominent, influential cross-cultural icons in this movie to give it the best chance of succeeding and being successful. And they've never really centered themselves because it's like they're like, if we did anything, we just created a platform. And then
Yes.
they did the, they did the work. It's almost like it's more stage director than film director, because usually the film director is at the center, but stage directors are kind of like in the wings, and it feels like they did this, they approached that on purpose.
Yeah, which I appreciate. And I think that's what, you know, I think when it's too often happens when white filmmakers are behind a film that is very black, as this has been described, and I tend to agree, that they can't help but to kind of put their own white perspective on it or their own white proxy in the movie in some way. But there's just none of that here. It's very much like kind of like what you said, where it's just like, I'm just going to be the stage director, but this is like I mean, I do think it was another situation. It might have been another situation where I think that Hollywood, in order to remake a white classic movie, you did need a white
A
director.
prominent Academy
Yes.
Award, multi-Academy Award nominated white director to be like, I've
Yes.
got this.
Yes.
I'm in charge.
They would not have trusted this with any black director, and that's not to
That's
excuse it,
nothing
but
about
that.
skill, but it's just like the reality of the time. Absolutely. And it's
Yes.
still it's somewhat the same to this day, which is
True.
that's what's more gross.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I mean, at least back then, they didn't lock you up in a Marvel or Disney contract and sit you on the bench for 4 years, not making anything except some kind of garbage animation movie. And then they finally release you to go and make stuff, and then everyone loves it. And I say this like as a person who's one of my favorite movies ever is Ryan Coogler's Creed. And I couldn't wait for him to, after Black Panther, I couldn't wait for him, the first one, and the tragedy passing of Chadwick Boseman, I couldn't wait for him to go and make something original again. I'm like, for the love of God, let this guy go make movies that he is not bound by a universe and nonsense. Just let him go and make movies. And look what happened. We've got to have
I
the
know.
best
I
movie of the
know.
year. It's like, and I can't wait to see what Barry Jenkins does next. I can't wait to see what Ava DuVernay does next. Every time these guys get benched by some company because they're making some stupid piece of IP, I'm like, I hope you guys bought a house, put money in the bank, bought, the speech from The Gambler. I hope you bought like a house with a 20-year roof, or like a shitty reliable car, and put $1 million in the bank, and then like you're set for life. You got fuck you money forever then. Right. I hope you can do that and then go and make us the interesting art that actually got you to the dance in the first place, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Barry Jenkins, for me, it's really Barry Jenkins and Ryan Coogler. I don't think that Barry Jenkins has missed at all. I think that Ryan Coogler, I like the fact that Ryan Coogler just has a lot of ideas on his mind. I think I'm a little colder on Sinners than I feel like the masses are, but I also think I think it still fits into everything that what you were saying about just being released from like this like intense IP shit that is
Yeah.
constantly like going on throughout Hollywood. And I would love to put an end to it or diversify it at least, for crying out loud. But like,
Yes.
yeah, I think that they are two of the most interesting Black filmmakers currently right now. But certainly not the only, but they're the two that I think that I'm always like kind of keeping an eye on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a guy who goes from Moonlight to If Beale Street Could Talk, which is stunning, by the way. If
It
anyone
is.
hasn't seen it, and it just, and the score is unbelievable. To If Beale Street Could Talk, then makes the Underground Railroad, which is an incredible feat in and of itself, and then makes the Mufasa movie. I'm like, this is wrong. Like, you guys, what did he do to deserve that? Now he can go and make anything that he wants forever. I'm like, yes, let's just let these guys go and make their movies that cost like $4 million and make 100 million, and then they'll be like, give them a blockbuster. And it's like, nah, just if you could just put $4 million in my bank once a year, I'll go make a movie. I'll go
It's
make.
so funny. I totally forgot about Mufasa.
Yeah, we
So I
know.
want
And you know what? I just want to let you know, I used a Men in Black memory wiper on you to at the beginning of the
to
show, and I'm going to use it on myself at the end of it to remind myself that Barry Jenkins has only indeed made those things and not Mufasa.
It's so funny because like, I was just saying he has not made a bad movie, but like I do want to correct myself that he definitely has with Mufasa. But something that I think about quite a bit, because he's not one of those directors that, or maybe her, he's not a director who has had so many films at once. I mean, I just remember that Medicine for Melancholy. I remember when I watched Medicine for Melancholy, and then I didn't hear anything about him for like a decade. And I thought that he had just retired. But it was just so weird because it was such a fantastic movie. And then people were kind of talking about Moonlight as though it was his debut feature. And I'm like, oh no, there was a movie
Oh, no.
that happened before that. And it
And
was very good.
it just took a while. It took a while. And then, he shot Moonlight in like 28 days or something like that. Like,
Unbelievable.
unbelievable.
And just
This is what I'm
so.
saying. There should be a fund. It's like the $4 million Barry Jenkins fund. He gets it once a year. And if he makes a movie, I would almost guarantee you it's going to make $50 million. And it's like, then another $4 million goes in the fund at the end of the year for him to go and make whatever the hell he wants, and an adaptation or whatever.
Yes, I'm for it.
I'm for
Let's
it.
do it. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of opportunity like that, certainly in the 70s, which is, I
No.
mean, gosh, was it the 60s when Van Peebles came up with Sweet Sweet Badass?
Yes, so what's it called?
Sweet, why am I?
Yeah, I'm
Because I
blanking.
feel like
I'm blanking on it too. It's called Sweetback's Badass Song is a thriller from 1971. So
So
they broadly chart like 68, again, it's all in that New Hollywood era. Melvin Van Peebles makes this action thriller. And so, but again, this is the same thing. Like, they're establishing themselves in this very specific sort of crime, urban crime drama that later on, like, lots of people look back to, and lots of people are influenced by, a lot of, contemporary white filmmakers are influenced by this period, like, Tarantino being one of them, who is so influenced by blaxploitation,
For
because
sure.
the movies have vitality and fun and life and all those sorts of things. And I think that, yeah, but at the time, they're not like allowing, they're not passing on the kindness of, like, here's X amount of money to do this huge movie. Like, that's not happening. There's no olive branch that's happening at this point in Hollywood. I think it's later that that starts to happen, because these filmmakers and their films are undeniable. They make money. Like, they shoot them for no money. They have to be super inventive and ingenious, coming up with how to, like, shoot things and do things on, like, a shoestring budget. And they always turn a profit. And some of them are huge critical hits as well. So, it eventually just became like, all right, this is undeniable. We have to give them a shot here.
Yeah, I mean, Sweet Back's Badass song is often credited by, like you said, a lot of filmmakers and certainly Quentin Tarantino. I think Melvin was also, or at least it seemed to me, very influenced by this spaghetti Western type of style.
Yeah.
It's very much kind of blended all in there, where it's just like this, like it's very, it's heightened, it's also really ridiculous,
Yes.
but it's largely very male, but it's very entertaining. It's just like, I'm gonna do this my way, and just it's gonna be just fantastical. And it's just like it really is like kind of melding this into, or folding this into, our broader Wiz conversation. I feel like it is melding this sense of fantastical, this sense of like, I'm going to create a film through the black imagination and just
Yes.
let it run. And wherever that takes us, we're just gonna go. No matter if all the narratives really totally make sense, it's just we're gonna go with it, because this sense of like freedom is something that I feel like these films are inherently chasing, like this devil may care type of like, this is in my hands. I'm just gonna do what I wanna do, and I wanna go ham if I want to go ham, things like
If
that.
there is nothing to me more cool and badass, just in general, than if you get a shot that you are uncompromisingly happy with what you produce. It could be hated by everyone, but I love an ambitious fail. Like, that tag sometimes get, like, an ambitious failure. I love that. I'm like, give me 10 ambitious failures that are trying to say something, that are searching for something, that are trying to do something unique and that don't quite work, versus something that's like, oh, well, I got all this money, I should just really play it safe. Like, that inclination is completely absent from this genre. It's like, no, we've got the money and we've got the time. We're gonna shoot the lights out. We're gonna do everything in a movie that I want to be there. We're gonna have action. We're gonna have attractive nude ladies. We're gonna, like, have no sense of, like, we're gonna skip all of the boring bits of the story. We're gonna shoot it like it looks like a Sergio Leone spaghetti Western, and we're gonna go ham. And I'm like, yes, all ticks for me. There's 4 stars from the gate. You turn the movie on, it's a 4 stars right at the beginning, because it's like you're uncompromising, you're going for it. So yeah, I think that that's really cool, and I think that that's The Wiz. The Wiz is really going for it, and all the creatives are really going for it. And, like, talk about, like, not understanding the experience, but hiring the best possible people to be there. Quincy Jones, all of these amazing actors, and it's like, we're going to give this a shot. We're going to be ambitious. And even if it was, a critical failure at the time, it's certainly been, like, heralded and held up by the black community. And I wasn't upset watching it. I'm like, I actually really, I my daughter hasn't finished watching The Wiz yet with me. It was too late in the evening for her to keep staying up, but I'm like, I'm going to probably, it's going to be on my TV again so that I can watch her reaction. So I'm excited for
Yeah,
that.
I love that. It's so interesting. So I think something that often comes up in conversation around Black filmmaking is just like, and I've heard Black filmmakers even talk about this, and other like Black actors who are in front of the camera, talk about like this ability, this having the freedom to fail,
Yes.
meaning like obviously the Wiz is a huge gamble.
Huge.
It's weird because on one end is not really a gamble because this is already an established and already like this is an established success, but it's also ex an established success in a very certain way. And so what happens when you kind of flip all of it or invert some, the image of it. And so I say that to say like this idea of the freedom to fail. And I think about like I recently this the film popped up in the Criterion Collection, and I saw someone say immediately, like, oh my gosh, like why is this film on the Criterion Collection? Like it's not really good. And I can't say that it's a great movie, but that just struck me because I was just like, well, Showgirls
Well,
is there.
you know what? I have a big physical media collection, and one of my pride and joy is, and it's actually on the shelf that you can probably see a little bit of behind me, and I'm going to grab it to show you, Candace.
Okay.
One second. Now, Candace, I'm going to do this very dramatically on my camera. What film am I holding that says the Criterion Collection? Ready?
Armageddon.
Armageddon is in the Criterion Collection, folks. I hold this beautiful DVD, which has one of the freaking most hilarious DVD commentaries of all time. I'll never let it leave my hands. It's Ben Affleck's commentary where he's just like slagging the movie off for the entire duration. But if Armageddon can get in there, surely the Wiz has the cultural footprint. I mean, and
That's
good,
it.
I defy good. It doesn't have to be good, you know. It has to be culture, like at significant. I think that's what Criterion's bent is, right? It's the significance to the culture, and those movies that have a huge and monumental influence. And I think that the Wiz's influence is, you know, I haven't even mentioned it now, but it's like you can probably see that Ryan Coogler has watched The Wiz if you've seen Sinners, you know, like you could probably say that that's, and I would say like there are plenty of movies that go in the Criterion Collection where you're like, I might not be the biggest fan of that movie, but sometimes you're like, oh, I'm really interested about that specific movie being released because there must be something there. There must be like, it's an interesting release. It's got a like great review and approach of like all the what it meant to culture, and I think it's way easier to put a whiz in there than something new. I think a contemporary movie is hard, but yeah, if Armageddon's in there, if Armageddon, this big gross double DVD that I've got that I'll never leave, that I'll never let lose out of my possession, then the whiz belongs there for sure.
It's funny. I will say I have never seen Armageddon, but my
Oh my
partner is
God.
always talking about it. And so I do need to eventually see it, and a lot of people have been talking about
Look,
it.
look, look. You'll have it. Look, you'll have a good time. You'll have it. You, like, it.
All
Even
I
if
want.
you, even if you detest it, you'll laugh. You'll be laughing. You'll be having a good
That's
laugh a long time with it.
so funny. Yeah, I mean, this is like,
And you too can ask yourself this question. Ben Affleck, who's one of the stars of the movie, the premise, I'm not spoiling anything, is that a bunch of drillers are trained to be astronauts so they can go and drill into a flying comet, meteorite, whatever you want to call it, that's like the size of Texas, to put a bomb in it to blow it up before it destroys Earth. And Ben Affleck asked Michael Bay, the director of this film, Michael, wouldn't it be easier for us as drillers to train astronauts to use our drill equipment in space? And to which Michael Bay's response was, shut the fuck up. Which
Stop
is
asking questions.
exactly what this movie is about. If you can get on board with that, I think you'll have a great time.
Of all, I had no idea that was the premise of the movie. I just
Oh
thought
my God.
it was about like Liv Tyler and something about Aerosmith. This is
That's
where
also the premise of the movie. Liv Tyler and something about Aerosmith.
this is my understanding of like cultural images that I've absorbed about or surrounding Armageddon at the time. But yeah, I mean, I think, when we talk about cultural significance, the question, when there is pushback on something like The Wiz, I have to think about like, well, whose culture does it have to be significant to, and
Yes.
why does it have to be like, you know, it's so interesting because, like, you know, obviously Black audiences watch everybody's movie, not just Black movies, but there's this understanding that, you know, white audiences, it has to be approved by white audiences, or it has to be something that's beloved by white audiences. And that's just a very old and
That person is a block. It's like it's just like no, I'm not engaging with you. I'm not starting this conversation. There's
But yeah,
enough
I mean,
filmmaking and culturally significant human beings in the Wiz to deserve a place in the Criterion Collection. This movie is made by Sidney Lumet. It's written by Joel Schumacher. It stars Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Richard Pryor, and the music's by Quincy Jones. End of conversation. I didn't even
end
mention
of
half the
conversation.
people, but like that's like there's enough Academy Award winning, culturally significant, blockbusting talent in just those few people we mentioned that it deserves a place in the Criterion Collection to say this is a culturally significant movie. Even just to for those people to have been in the movie. The movie could have colossally failed, and half of the print could be set on fire 20 minutes into the movie, and you can't watch the rest, it would still deserve a place in the Criterion Collection just for those people being in it.
True.
And it
Also, I
wasn't.
mean, again, I have to stress, Showgirls is in the Criterion Collection, and I think Crystal Girls is a horrendous movie, and it's a movie that I've only seen recently, like in the last 2 years, and I was just like, but it's so interesting because that's a movie that spectacularly failed in a critical sense, but has had this resurgence of like people who have really liked it, and that's been really interesting to me. For some reason,
I think
it
can I
is
give you the
having
take? Can I give you the take on that? I
that.
think it is because that when people saw Showgirls, I think a lot of them were thinking it was going to be like, let's say the first Magic Mike, right? Bit of a cautionary tale of going to Vegas, becoming an exotic dancer, trying to get fame and fortune, and ultimately, it's made by a guy named Paul Verhoeven, who's a terrific filmmaker, a satirist first, made RoboCop, which is, I think is its best one-to-one Basic Instinct. It's a satire about America, that all America is this big, glorified stripper, disgusting, gross thing that all it's going to do, all it is this empty fame that relies on sex and nothingness, and at the end of the movie, you get nothing. And I think it's a satire. So I wouldn't say I like Showgirls. Like I'm not that person. I'll leave that to some people like Adam Neiman, who's a great critic who I respect tremendously, to be like, it's actually good. But I would absolutely watch it because if you watch it as a satire, it works, and it works actually in a way that kind of makes you uncomfortable. And I would imagine if you're an American person, you watch it like a satire about your country and about the American experience for from in that sense, it's like it's a satire. But it also is patently ridiculous. It's patently ridiculous. And yeah, so we don't have to, I think there's always something, and sometimes even a movie that is hated, I actually think that that does belong in the Criterion Collection because it's like if this was the most hated movie of a decade, that should be there. Like,
Well, it means
let's
it's
have the
significant
comment.
in a
Yeah,
different
let,
sense.
exactly. Yeah, let's see why it was the most hated thing. But look, Candice, this has been so awesome chatting to you. This has been such a sprawling convo about a million things. I appreciate your time so much. I know that for folks who are looking for what Candice is up to, the best place to find her is what just your socials or your.
Yeah, right now it's just socials. And whenever I do write, I'll post those articles on my socials.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll make sure I put all the links. Candice Frederick, thank you so much for talking to me about The Wiz and our love of Quincy Jones. And you know what's only going to happen now? You're going to watch
Well,
Armageddon. You're going to watch
obviously
Armageddon.
I don't have to watch that.
Can't wait to, I will be following keenly as I do on your socials to see when you watch Armageddon. I'm very excited.
Absolutely.